I just, because we don't have the votes to pass it, we're going to wait till Representative Buehler can be. Like you anymore. Is this the way this works?
We call a House Committee on Health Care to order. Sorry that we're a little late. Stuff's going on around the building. I'm going to announce that we are carrying over House Bill 4062 and House Bill 4105 until Monday. There's several work sessions scheduled for Monday. It should be a busy day. We also still will have time for what we don't complete on Monday to carry over till Wednesday, so we have a little leeway. Do we have a quorum?
Well, we do have a quorum, but I haven't heard from Representative Kenny Geyer and Representative Clem.
They're in caucus right now.
So
I think they will.
Is Rep. Perry?
Clem will Representative.
I don't see her.
Clem will be here soon.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
You said 4062 and 4105, correct?
That's correct.
Thank you.
We will work 4016 as soon as we have a quorum, or soon after.
Do we have an order of hearing?
You
usually give us a clue, and it's just helpful.
We have quorum now, don't we?
Yeah.
Well, we're trying to wait for them so we don't have to suspend the rules to let them vote again.
Okay.
But yes, we do have a quorum. If you want to do it.
Is Representative Parrish here? What time do we expect here? Quarter after?
Yeah, 1:15. We were going to do the work sessions first. Let me go get the sign up sheets.
Yeah. Let me see.
Sure.
I'll stand at ease for a moment. Sorry to be so disorganized today. It's a disorganizing day. We're going to have a work session on one bill.
Okay.
Which we'll do right now.
All right.
Let's do that.
Thank you.
Let's open the work session on House Bill 4016. Madam Administrator, what do we have?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, 4016, you recall, is permitting all of the health professional boards to contract for their impaired health professional programs. Currently, we have OHA that contracts with it, and with the Dash 1 amendment, it allows all boards to do their own contracting directly with the health professional program, monitoring portion of that program. So we have, and we do have a revenue and a fiscal impact statement. The fiscal impact statement just outlines and identifies the current funding stream and how that money will be transferred over to the four boards that basically are using the program right now.
This, I think we have, everybody's ready to move this bill. I want to put on the record that, as a part of the legislative history, that we expect a contract between the boards and the agency to make sure there are safeguards and sideboards on it that protects the agency from having to disclose information that ought not properly be disclosed to the boards. I want to make sure we understand that. Right now, the feeling was that OHA served the function of buffering between the board and the agency, that and we had testimony from the medical board that would be a part of the process that went forward. I want to make sure we get that very clearly on the record. Can I take a motion for this bill?
Are you ready?
Yep.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 4016, dated January 26, 2016.
January 26. Representative Notes moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 4016, dated January 26, 2016. Is there any discussion on the motion? Is there any objection? So moved.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move that House Bill 4016 be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
As amended.
Representative Nose moves House Bill 4016 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Would you please call the roll? Excuse.
Aye.
Representative
Kinnear? Aye.
Representative
Kinnegar? Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Wagner?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hayden?
Aye.
Vice Chair Notes?
Yes.
And Chair Greenwood?
Aye. Motion carries. Somebody like to carry this thing?
I will.
Is this to the floor?
Actually, someone else can.
You can do it if you do it seriously.
How about Rep. Gilliam?
Rep. Gilliam.
No.
This isn't Gilliam's bill.
No, this.
Different one.
Actually,
I'll be happy to do it.
Or some Wagner, that'd be fine. Take your responsibility seriously.
You do it.
I've been known to pull teeth once or twice.
Oh, here we go. Close the work session on House Bill 4016. Okay, if we can send these for one second, let me see.
What? Representative Parrish is here.
Okay. Good. I will open up a public hearing on House Bill, where are we?
4029.
4029, and ask Representative Parrish to come forward.
Chair Greenlight, members of the committee, for the record.
Welcome.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it on this fine Friday. For the record, Julie Parrish, House District 37, Westland, Tualatin, bringing you today House Bill 4029, which I am sponsored on with Senator Betsy Johnson. And I actually have, there's a dash one amendments, but I want to talk real fast about the underlying bill and how we got it here. So my first term, I was on the House Healthcare with some of you. And when we were talking about really big conversations like Cover Oregon and CCOs, one of the little pieces that sort of got breezed over was this Cadillac tax on health care. And I remember asking at the time some of the folks who are no longer with us in the Oregon Health Authority, what about this little tax thing? And it started due in a couple years, and they're like, oh, no, it'll get pushed off. And it did. It went out to 2018, and Congress just moved it again to 2020, which actually creates us a little bit of a different dilemma because they're not, as they're pushing that out, increasing the caps along with it. And so it's like, no, don't worry about that. We'll figure that out later. Well, later basically is here. And so what the Cadillac tax, most of you know, is an excise on the difference between the cost of your premiums. And premium is things like the actual health care premium, contributions to an HSA. It does not include long-term health, vision, or dental. But could be school-based health care. And there's some other things that are still, you know, looking to get wrapped in. So here's the cap, and Congress sets the cap, and if your plans are over, and you know some of our public employers like TriMet are over, then the tax is assessed at a 40% on the delta. Pretty significant, and nobody has gotten a really good handle. PEBS had some numbers. OEBS had some numbers. I've heard Lane County say as much as $4 million. My local school district with no change is like $1 million. Those are real numbers that are just going to get sucked out of Oregon and go like to Uncle Sam, and we already give our federal government a dollar, and the federal government is not returning us a dollar and hasn't for about 30 years is what our office can tell. So I'm not interested in sending them more. And Oregon has done a good job in trying to take care of its Medicaid population. So private employers are trying to deal with this, and they're making their changes in a more localized way. But we have a lot of public employees, and we have a lot of schools and local governments that are going to be affected by this. So what House Bill 4029 is attempting to do, and originally John Kitzhaber was thinking about moving our public employees into the CCOs, which I wasn't a fan of that idea. I'd like to give our public employees something a little more flexible. And so 4029 originally was designed to move public employees into the exchange, offer some new opportunities that say you were double covered, that instead you would get what Congress has set as your single cap, and you could use it for daycare, and you could use it for putting money into retirement if you already had health care from some other means, and offer workers more flexibility sort of in the time and place and manner in which they really need to think about how their benefits affect their families and solve a lot of the problems we're trying to solve here. Congress did move that cap out, and if they move the cap but they didn't raise the cap, then when our health care costs increase, we're going to see that delta on the 40% actually is going to grow. So nice that we have a little more time to try to solve the problem. Not great that the tax liability, if it does go into effect in 2020, actually gets worse. And so the Dash 1 Amendment is actually proposing that we have a task force to study this. The chair has suggested that maybe there's a few things in here in the language that, you know, he want to see changed, and I'm happy to do that. But really, we need to bring in people from the governor's office. We need legislators engaged. We need members of insurance. We need members of our local governments, transit authorities, and we need members of our workforce and their unions to all come around to the table and go, the federal government is moving us in a direction that maybe we may or may not like with the affordable health care, but we have to just respond. Whether we agree with the ACA or not, as legislators, we are obligated to respond to what we're being asked to do. And we need to be thoughtful about making sure that we're protecting our local dollars and keeping them in our communities. So I am asking this committee in this short session for a task force so we can come together with a very thorough policy concept that gets us out from under the tax, gives workers the great benefits, as best of benefits as we can afford to give. The interesting thing, and I've run this by some economists, I've run it by our treasurer, I've run it by a lot of people, I've talked to a lot of people, is that there's also an opportunity by moving people in the exchange to create some savings. And what could that savings do? And in the original bill, it would be for things like other collective bargaining. So let's say a school district saves some money because they made a shift in their health care. If they wanted to have a student loan payback for their teachers, fine. This bill says that they could do that. It could also be used to sort of hold budgets and not have to RIF employees during a reduction of force during a down economic time if they could use their savings that way. But it also would have required that that every time the federal government increases based on the CPI, that 50% of any savings that a local government would save would have to be banked so that we can pay for that cost of living increase on the health care side. So the net result, though, is that in theory, if we calculate the numbers and have some time to look at it, you could put a chunk of savings to the PERS cost, still deliver quality benefits, offer people more flexible benefits instead of a one-size-fits-all, and, you know, and be smart about how we spend taxpayer dollars and deliver services. You know, I come to this building, and I've heard a lot of interesting conversations on our House floor this week about why we are here or not here, and I come with one lens, and that lens is to protect the taxpayers and deliver services and make sure that the people who do the work are treated fairly. That's the lens I come. So every bill that I bring, everything that I look at is through that lens. And I think we have an obligation to look at what is a very big chunk of our budget and be thoughtful, intellectually honest, and curious about how we solve such a problem, still respect the worker, respect the taxpayer, and not see our money get sucked out and go to Texas or Florida or all these other states who didn't work as hard as we have worked to solve our issues with our underserved healthcare population. So for that, I am asking for a task force. I would love to have your support. I would happy to be continue to be engaged in this until we find a way to solve it that is really fair and equitable to everybody. And I appreciate you listening today. So thank you.
Well, I really appreciate you bringing this. I've got indications that if we put forth a task force, it'll get killed in Ways and Means. So what I would like to suggest is if you and I would be willing to lead a work group in the interim.
You bet.
I'd be happy to work with you on this one.
I would love to pull the same types of people I think we've outlined in the language, really, who is should be here. And we have a work a task force that got, or a work group that it got assigned in my forestry bill. And it was very flexible. We said, here's the types of people we'd like to have, and anybody else can come who's welcome. And you're welcome to sit at the table. So I'm willing to get around the table with anybody for and set up meetings. You know, the nice thing about the task force is it is staffed, so we do versus a work group. So we need to figure out.
Our staff our work group.
We'll do it? So awesome. We'll okay, I have to say I've been on lots of work groups with Sandy already, and she's awesome, so I want that officially on the record, but and she deserves
okay,
a lot of patience for doing
it. Sucking up works?
Come on, no. She's going to ask for a raise.
Practitioners, like, how many of these have we done, right? So, yeah, great.
I also am going to ask Peb to come in toward the end of the month while we still have time, and if you want to join us, and ask them to explain why they think they've solved the problem.
Absolutely. So I appreciate that, Chair, and I know you know this is a problem, and this is not, you know, this is not a partisan issue. This is about, we got
it's
workers
a real
who are,
issue.
It's a real issue, and we can't just have our money leave our state. And I'll tell you, TriMet, some of the other, you know, transit districts, some of the other local governments who have very high dollar plans are over, some of them are close to or going to be over these caps before the caps go into effect. So that is a problem, and we do need to deal with it and help people get those costs under control. Because ultimately, we are here to serve the taxpayer, make sure that the trains move and, you know, school lunch gets fed and all the things that we need to do is working in our system. And so I just appreciate it. So thank you.
And well, Rob, thank you very much. Yes. Representative Knowles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Hayden. Representative Hayden on deck.
So, Representative Parrish, you maybe know, in my other day job, I work for a union, and I've been around benefit negotiations and PEB and a lot of other trusts that are similar to PEB. And I'm curious, are you aware, unaware, are these entities also kind of trying to figure this out and looking at this? I mean, and not just ignoring it. That's what I'm...
Didn't even know. I met with the university president maybe before the end of the year, end of last year, and said, hey, do you know about this little Cadillac tax problem? And they're like, what? So there are, I think people are not tracking it. And, you know, the question is, it's like, whose committee does it fall in? Is it a business and labor because it's got a labor side? It's not really a healthcare delivery problem. And so I think it flew under our radar for a really long time because maybe nobody was tracking it, because if it was a healthcare problem, or people who are interested in business problems of our state think, well, the healthcare committee should be dealing with it. Like, it didn't have a home. And I think that's really been the biggest problem. And so there hasn't been a lot of awareness up until recently. I think individually, some people are tracking it. I've got a school district business manager who's like, I sort of get the problem, but I don't really understand it all the way. But they've started to really dig into it now that I've talked to them. So I think that up until when I brought the bill in 2015, at the beginning of 2015, I will say this was not a problem that was understood at the beginning of the last session.
Can I just make a quick comment, Mr. Chair? I think it would be really important, if we proceed with this idea, to have OEB and PEB and TriMet and some of the, like, for example, in my day job, representing workers at Multnomah County, their version of PEB is wrestling with this, and I'm guessing a lot of these entities are, and I think we would just want to hear from them about what they're trying to do, because I don't think maybe we're not paying attention to it in this committee, but I think these entities are very much trying to figure
and
it
I
out.
I think we'll hear from some of them this month before we're done.
And Representative Knowles, I do want to just say, PEB has put some numbers out. There was an op-ed from OEB where they're like, we had a meeting last month, and we're starting to engage with this. So, but when you're not factoring in, and what I've talked to PEB and heard from them in my office previous, and they have said, one, it will still cost us some money. We're trying to find ways to reduce it, but it's not net neutral, I don't think, by any stretch of the imagination, is what I understand. And then the other is, it really isn't factoring the other things that trigger the cap, which is like HSA contributions, potentially any healthcare delivered in a school-based health center. It's a bigger problem than just the premiums, even COBRAs
and
that.
And the employees' contributions.
Employee contribution. Well. Like, there's like all these other factors than just like what the state paying, that actually Congress, if you look at that, you know, that language in the ACA, is being requiring us to wrap in as part of total health care compensation.
Anything that comes with pre-tax dollars
sort of in that mix. 125 accounts right now, they're still trying to figure out if, like, which is what school districts use for some of their flex benefits. That's even up in the air. Are those in? Are those out? You know, the nice thing is Congress did carve out long-term care and dental and vision, so that gives us some additional flexibility as we calculate benefits.
And we have a delay, so we have more time to worry about it.
But the tax will be bigger.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. Thank you, Representative Parrish. This is a concern of mine also. It's been kind of a lonely voice. I appreciate you bringing it up. As we look around even our state, we look at health insurance companies struggling, potentially failing, even though that they're raising rates at 25% on your premiums annually. So as we look at this from a federal level, you are correct. Those prices, and it's $10,200, is locked in. And so as we move forward, this is going to move from a Cadillac tax to a Yugo tax. And so the bar is going to get lower and lower and lower until basically everybody's taxed on this. And I think our job is to try to figure out how to combat raising health care price. So I encourage you.
Thank you. Okay.
Mr. Winkles, would you like to join us?
Thank you. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, Scott Winkles representing the League of Oregon Cities. And also, I have been asked by the rep- my colleague Rob Bovet from counties to state that our views reflect the AOC, the Association of Oregon Counties view as well. League of Oregon Cities, in conjunction with the Association of Oregon Counties, collectively, and for lack of a better phrase, operate sort of a joint venture, city-county insurance services. And this is a self-insured pool that provides, among other things, health insurance benefits to most of the small, mid-sized cities and counties in the state of Oregon. Most of the rest of our city membership are typically self-employed or self-insured as well entities, so Portland, your larger cities. Cities and counties have been acutely aware of our health care costs for some time, and the impacts of the Cadillac tax in particular. Our plans are going through some changes right now to look at making sure that we're underneath that cap. We are somewhat stymied. All we have to determine our exposure to risk under the current caps is the statutory language. We're still waiting to see from the federal government the regulatory language as well as to and the rules and the guidance on how to calculate who is and is not covered under the cap. And that was one of the, I believe that was part of the reasons, there were a number of reasons that Congress elected to move the effective date of the cap tax back. We're working with our employees through the collective bargaining process right now to address these issues at the local level, and we have a city-county insurance services has an excellent track record at keeping our costs below costs low, and we believe that we should be able to make these decisions locally. We would look forward to participating in a work group and share our experiences with you, but I have to get on the record that the bill as written is something that we have significant concerns with.
Thank you very much. The bill's not going anywhere, so okay. Shouldn't be a problem. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
All right.
Appreciate that. Close the public hearing on House Bill 4029. Open the public hearing on House Bill 4017. Madam Administrator.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4017 requires the Department of Consumer and Business Services, in collaboration with the Oregon Health Authority and the Stakeholder Advisory Group, to create a blueprint for the basic health program. It specifies the requirement for the program. It grants sole authority to the department to submit the waiver for the state's innovation under the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. This has a declares an emergency effective on passage. We have several amendments that I've identified on the staff measure summary, but they've kind of been replaced. So we're now looking at a dash 4 amendment, a dash 5 that replaces the dash 2, and a dash 6 that replaces the dash 5. And we have individuals that will speak to those amendments individually.
Would you call the panel?
Sure. Jim Bunn, Joe Bell, Ozzie Rose.
Go for it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jim Bunn, representing Advantage Dental out of Redmond. And there are five are of concern in the original bill, and I have to say I didn't catch this bill until this morning, so I haven't seen the amendments. I apologize for that. But when it defines the basic health program as covering what's currently in the state medical assistance program, except for dental care for adults, that creates a problem and sends us back a long way. I was mentioning to Representative Kinnemer that he and I served in the Senate together with Governor Kitzhaber as we passed the Oregon Health Plan. And as we were debating this in 1989, the key was prioritizing. We knew we couldn't cover everything for everybody, but it made no sense to to have some with a huge package and others with nothing. So we expanded coverage over, and I mentioned it had been 17 years, and he said, no, it's 27 years. It's been a long process where we have been prioritizing, refining, and with the transformation process, I remember the governor talking about the air conditioner for the elderly woman and the need for a common sense approach to what we're doing. Well, if we're looking at a common sense approach, these six words, eliminating dental care, are not common sense. I recall being in a meeting in Idaho when I had an abscess tooth and I couldn't concentrate on anything. I left the meeting and came home and had that dealt with. But to say to people, an abscess tooth isn't covered, doesn't make sense. So dental care is prioritized just like every other part of medical care. An abscess tooth is high, a gold crown is low. Your committee last session passed House Bill 3506 to say dentures should be included, and the abscess tooth issue came up again. And ultimately, Ways and Means took that issue and passed the benefit, which we're still working to get implemented because it's not a high enough priority. So I think we've made great progress in 27 years. This bill has six words that need to come out. I will go to LC this afternoon and ask that that be taken out so that we do not begin to define our medical care as absent dental care.
Joe, I expect you have some similar thoughts on the matter.
Yes, for the record, I'm Joe Bell with Capital Dental Care, and we agree with what he said, and have been very proud of the legislature for its support for dental care and its understanding of the impact that oral health has on overall health. The only thing that I would maybe add is that in reading through the bill, and again, I haven't also seen the amendments, but where it talks about requesting the waiver and having that brought back to the legislature before the waiver can be sent, I think that there's a word missing there, and possibly that is an approval from the legislature of what that package might be. And the other thing too that I have a concern with is that the bill gives a chance, and I understand we're sort of dancing between the Oregon Health Plan and a basic health insurance policy, but it's a little concerning to me that someone might select to have a CCO and receive those services, and the person who selected the basic health plan insurance product wouldn't have those same services. So those are some of our concerns. Thank you.
For the record, I'm Leslie Rose. I'm here representing Multnomah ESD today, and our interest in the bill is the relating clause. We have an amendment to fix something that was passed last session. In 2015, you passed House Bill 3149 that provided that a registered nurse employed by a public school, public or private school, could administer prescriptions by a doctor from outside the state to a child as long as the child hadn't been in the school for more than 90 days. So it was set up to help kids who come into the state with prescriptions, and we can still deal with it. The problem with the language in the bill, there wasn't much problem with the bill. I don't think anybody objected to it. But over half of the nurses in schools are employed by Multnomah ESD and public health places in some counties, et cetera. So the bill left or did not allow those folks to do this. So all we're asking you to do is add the words, a registered nurse who is employed by a public or private school or by an education service district or a local public health authority as defined in ORS 431, et cetera, et cetera. So all it's doing is taking what you passed last time and make it work for all the schools in the state. Thank you.
I don't see anybody will have any problem with that. That's the -4 amendments.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I don't think there'd be. Are there any questions, Pat?
I have a question. And this will be for your panel as well as the others. So I served on this task force, and I am passionate about dental care, almost as passionate as my colleague here. And we really wanted to do dental care, but we were also trying to find a plan for the basic health plan where it would be cost neutral. That was our direction. And the basic health plan is primarily meant for two populations. One is people that don't have access to Oregon Health Plan because they're on the five-year bar, they're immigrants on the five-year bar, or the COFA population and others, who currently don't have Oregon Health Plan, which means they don't have any dental access. So that's one population. The other population is the people between 133 or 138% of federal poverty level and 200% who are having a really hard time purchasing the and paying for the premiums. Even with the subsidy, it ends up being too much for many of them, and I forget what the percentage is. The chair always corrects me. Something like only 40% are signing up when they could be. That population, when they buy a plan, does dental access come automatically with that plan, or they have to purchase it separately? My understanding is they still have to purchase it. It doesn't come along with the plans. And so the population that we're trying to help with here do not currently have dental access. Is that correct? I'm seeing some nodding. A plan that all of a sudden is going to replace what we currently have in place and take away dental access. This is a plan that will provide basic health insurance to people who are either precluded from having it categorically because of their immigration status or are having a hard time affording it, and they do not currently have dental. My greatest dream is the reason that I'm such an advocate for doing this blueprint is that we need to know what the numbers are, and if there is any way that we can squeeze out money to, in addition to these basic health services, include dental, I will fight for it tooth and nail.
But I
want to make very clear that this plan is not taking away something that people have currently. It is adding things, and we would like to go farther and add dental when we can.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kinnegeyer, I think that the key is not to say what can we afford and we'll carve out dental entirely, but to say what can we afford and then go back to the prioritization list and say, what can we do? You know, we've struggled from day one. The feds did not give us a clear waiver that let us come up the list or down the list as far as money was available. But we, with a fixed amount of money, we can say, look at the prioritization list and see what we can cover so that we don't leave out high priority dental while funding a lower priority medical side.
Right.
Let's move on.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Can you call the next panel, please?
Jeremiah Rigsby and Janet Bauer.
I asked folks to be relatively brief. We're not quite as much of a panic as we were.
And we could... BJ?
Good afternoon.
I'm sorry. I'm hating this today.
We're waiting.
Oh, excuse me. Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, and members of the committee. My name is Janet Bauer. I'm a policy analyst with the Oregon Center for Public Policy. OCPP participates with the Inclusion, Affordability, and Innovation Coalition, which, amongst other things, supports consideration of a basic health program. House Bill 4017 is an appropriate next step to determine the best ways to address the fact that too many Oregonians still don't have health insurance. As I know you're aware, and this committee has discussed, low-income workers are having the most trouble affording the available coverage. And these cash-strapped individuals are most likely to go without care, even if they are covered, because they can't afford the charges. Most are U.S. citizens. Some are legal permanent residents barred from Medicaid, and Pacific Islanders residing under the Compact for Free Association. This committee have long recognized that health reform is a work in process. It's not perfect, and we're not done. And for a number of years, you have taken steps to address the problems in the gaps in coverage. Recognizing that basic health is a potential solution, in 2014 you commissioned a feasibility study to analyze its prospects, and seeing that there is potential for that program, as a result of that analysis, you asked stakeholders over the past year to consider how a basic program could be structured in Oregon that would meet some particular goals. So that brings us up to the current bill, House Bill 4017, and I speak to the Dash 5 amendment. We'll continue to move this process forward. As I promised last month, we worked closely with the Department of Consumer and Business Services on some amendments that they were interested in, and easily found the language that was suitable that's represented in the Dash 5. So the Dash 5 amendment directs stakeholders to create a blueprint for basic health that best addresses the problems that low-income working families are having. It requires the group to consider the recommendations of the last stakeholder work group, but it leaves flexibility to create the strongest and most feasible program. So while there are specific recommendations that we discussed and in the past, and they will be considered, the stakeholders will not be obligated to implement those per se. There are many ways, I think, that we made a lot of progress on that work group. There's, I'm sure, more light to be shed, and in terms of finding a program that works really well for our health system here in Oregon. The Dash 5 requires an updated actuarial analysis. The previous estimates were really helpful, but they're now out of date. We really need current numbers. The amendment leaves open the possibility for applying under the waiver for state innovation, which is an option that Oregon Senator Ron Wyden included in the ACA, and to explore whether that could be a good fit, perhaps even better than the basic health section in the ACA. Both avenues require subsequent legislative approval before submittal of any waiver. This is important work, and there, you know, as you may be aware, there are many questions that are still open, including finding a way to include adult dental, in my view. House Bill 4017-5 is the right next step on behalf of Oregonians who aren't already getting care, and I urge you to approve this. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Chair Meyer.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, my name is Jeremiah Rigsby. I represent Care Oregon. We own Columbia Pacific up in the northwest portion of the state, Columbia Pacific CCO, and we own Jackson Care Connect down in Jackson County. We're also affiliated with HealthShare in the metro area. We have long been interested in the basic health plan. There's been a lot of work done to talk about how the basic health program would impact Oregonians. I know that work started in the Medicaid Advisory Committee almost a year and a half ago with OHA staffing that, and has continued through the work of the task force that I know Representative Kenan Geyer was on, as well as Janet. As that conversation has grown, I think more people have become interested. I think we represent a certain portion of the healthcare industry, but we don't represent all of the healthcare industry. And that is becoming kind of clear as more of the healthcare industry, which I think all agrees that access is an important thing and that this population is something that we want to provide quality healthcare to. We just, I think, are starting to get to a point where we're wondering the best way to do that. And I think there are more voices now that are interested in weighing in on how best to address this situation. The great thing about this bill is it gives those voices an opportunity to be heard. Now that we are seeing, I think, some specific things from other members of the healthcare industry that they would like to see addressed with the basic health plan, we can talk about because of this bill, and if this bill is passed, we could talk about how best to incorporate those ideas into moving forward. That could include adult dental. That could include concerns about what this is going to do to the individual market, which I know has already been addressed briefly by the previous task forces, I should say. One thing I also want to make clear about what this bill does is it provides information to the legislature about how best to move forward. Anything that this task force would come up with isn't anything set in stone. It's literally providing a blueprint that the legislature could vote on, that the legislature could change and vote on. It's the beginning, or I should say it's the next step of a conversation that's been going on for much time. So Care Oregon and our CCOs are very supportive of continuing this conversation. This bill helps us do that, and this bill also helps get the rest of the healthcare industry into the room to talk about how it could be possible to provide access to this population.
You support the fives, is that right?
Yes, Chair Greenlee, members of the committee. We are in support of the Dash 5 amendments.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is B.J. Kavanaugh. I serve as Executive Director of 1 in 4 Chronic Health, and I'm here today to support the bill with the Dash 6 amendment. We view this as critical. Have you had a chance to review the Dash 6 amendment, or?
Sorry. As you speak.
Apologize. I just want to make sure they're in front of you. We view this as critical to the job that we started with healthcare reform in Oregon oh so many years ago. We all knew that there was a population that was not going to be able to be covered, and this is an important step towards that population. You know, the 88,000 people estimated who would be impacted by this and be able to get care, including the 15,000 low-wage workers. And this is very important as we're looking and having discussions about raising minimum wage and what that's going to do to access for insurance for people. It's critical we have these discussions. Also, the permanent residents, the 9,000 permanent residents who aren't able to access Medicaid for the five-year ban, and the 1,500 COPA citizens, the Pacific Islanders who we nuked their home and aren't able to access Medicaid either. We owe it to them to provide services to them and to do this, to do the right thing. I think it's important that we look a little bit about the federal poverty level here and talking about what we're talking about. It's one thing to say 138 to 200. What that means in dollars is $16,423 to $23,540. Now, these are our friends and neighbors, our family, who are eking out a living, and this is the right thing to do. Yes, it could be better. Yes, we should include dental. Yeah, we should include vision as well. Eyeglasses are ridiculously expensive. But this is a start. It's a good start. We support the Dash 6 because it will give it will allow the important anti-discrimination provisions that other Oregonians have, either currently through their insurance or hopefully many more will have if we are able to pass the legislation we're working on. But it's important that we have these protections in place so that people are not discriminated against on the basis of their age, pre-existing condition, or potential conditions that may develop in time. I'll just close by saying that this is part of the triple aim. This is what we are supposed to be doing, and I would ask and urge you to support this. And thank you. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question is, how does that fit with the Dash 5s?
How does that fit the Dash 5s?
Dash 6 is independent of Dash 5.
I am going to ask that I can get back to you.
I guess my question is more,
is it a compatible addition
is what I'm asking, really.
The Dash 6 essentially removes some of the concerns around formulary that I believe were concerns that were possibly holding things up and makes it a little bit clearer. And I can get back to you with a better answer. I apologize. That's as much information as I have at the moment.
Okay.
Oh, thank you.
Will you call the next panel, please?
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Jim Gardner and Jessica Adamson. And then that's it, Mr. Chair.
And then what?
That's it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner. I represent the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, or PhRMA. I would simply echo the comments previously by the many witnesses that this is a very, very important program. We support it strongly. Share the concern about adult dental if you can find the way to finance it. to answer Representative Kennemer's question, with some tweaking, the dash fives and the dash sixes will live together. But they'll need to be tweaked a little bit, because if your cross references and so forth might need to be fixed. The goal, as BJ just testified, the goal of the dash six is to ensure, to build into the planning process, the framework from the very get go, the principle that that this program should respect the needs of vulnerable populations. And it was interesting, Mr. Chair, Representative Kenny Geyer sort of asked me a little bit earlier today, well, shouldn't that already be obvious? And it should, but it doesn't help to call it out.
It doesn't hurt to call it out.
And, Mr. Chair, I would also mention that, as per our discussion, we have taken out the formulary review provisions.
We have a dash seven.
They're already out.
The dash six has the formulary.
They're gone.
Oh, formulary. Dash six has gone.
Okay. Yes.
Thank you. Jessica?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson with Providence Health and Services. If I may, we'd like to start by reiterating that Providence, at our heart and mission, is to serve the poor and vulnerable. We believe that those that are categorically excluded from coverage absolutely need access. It is critical that those with incomes below 200% of the federal poverty level have access to insurance, have access to affordable drugs, and can engage and receive the health care that they and their families need. We are very engaged in the community in making that happen. As a system, when patients walk through our doors and they're below 200% of the federal poverty level, they automatically qualify for charity care, and we will cover anything that isn't covered as part of their insurance plan. We believe that this is essential in order to promote access. And so what I say that follows shouldn't be at all interpreted as any lack of commitment to serving this population. We are committed to leaning in and finding solutions that provide care. All of that said, we have some concerns about the bill as presented and about the dash fives. We are concerned that the bill as we read it, including page 2 of the dash fives, lines 1 through 3, and page 4 of the bill, lines 17 through 22, require reports to the legislature, but no specific requirements for approval. And we would suggest very strongly, in agreement with Joe Bell, that this require approval, legislative approval of the blueprint before the waiver is submitted. We think that's pretty important, that there is agreement that we're directionally correct on a path before we wander through the waiver process, that's pretty critical. Additionally, we would recommend.
Give me a moment.
Yeah.
Would you, outside of the committee meeting, would you check with the council and see whether the legislative approval is intended or not by the way it's written? Let's put that on the record by Monday.
I thought you.
Thank you.
I was asking you to check in with the council.
Will do.
If we are reading it wrong, we're happy to retract that, but our reading is that specific vote of the legislature does not appear to be required, and we just want to make sure that that's...
We'll find out whether it is.
Thank you, sir. The second thing that we would say is that we believe that it would be helpful to direct the work group putting together the blueprint to examine two scenarios, one being inclusion of categorically excluded individuals, as well as those under 200% of the FPL that are currently on the exchange. Look at a plan that engages all of those, and then also look at a plan that specifically addresses those that are category excluded alone. The what we understand about how the basic health plan would act operationally would be to move those under 200% of the FPL into a separate risk pool. The plans may be sold on the exchange, but the lives, about a third of the lives on the exchange, would be moved into a separate risk pool. And so you are eliminating the spread of risk in that section of the population, and we would suggest that we need to make sure that we fully understand the impact on the market before we do that, and the stability of the market. Not that maybe that isn't a good idea, but we think that in order to fully understand the impact, that we do that. We support updating the cost study and the actuarial analysis. Understanding the costs are essential. And we are looking forward to being actively engaged in this dialogue should this bill move forward. We are more than happy to engage in providing our suggested adjustments to this bill, if that is the pleasure of this committee. Again, we have concerns at the moment, but eagerly look forward to being able to not have any concerns about this bill, and again, work towards making sure that this population has full access to care. That is what we do every day, and we fully look forward to leaning in and making that happen.
Thank you very much, Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick, and I want to thank everybody for their testimony on this bill. As a proponent of health care and a provider, I believe it's definitely our duty and obligation to find efficient ways to provide health care, and I want to point out that this is a waiver system. This is something that we're asking the federal government to look at approving. I think it is critical, and thank you, Chair Greenlick, for getting that clarification that the that we have the opportunity here at the state legislature to review what this plan is. And so we know what we're asking for and approve that. So I think that's one critical point. The other point is that the landscape in healthcare is changing all the time. It's going to take a while to build this. As we look across the nation at our co-ops, many, many of those co-ops are not successful. They're failing. We're seeing some of that reaction here in the state of Oregon. And so to say definitely that this population is going to go into this exchange under kind of the co-op formulary now, I think is premature to second guess that that's still going to be the avenue that we want to use in a year. So I think we need to keep open-minded about it. I'm concerned about writing in exclusions for the policymakers to begin with the adult dental concern. So I think we need to leave it open to a possibility of a waiver being just that we have to be nimble to move to what the current healthcare marketplace is, how those co-ops are functioning now, and how they're functioning when this plan gets together, and have a real honest talk about that before we send it off for the waiver. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So thank you for all your comments. Thanks for all the testimony here. And I'm not sure that we're trying to push them into a co-op kind of delivery system. That's having served on the task force, I don't believe that that's, you know, where we're heading. We're heading toward a CCO being able to offer a plan or a health insurance provider offering a plan. And so co-ops didn't actually come up, although there's no reason why they couldn't also offer a plan. But the other thing I was going to say is the blueprint is to give us more exact numbers, because we did not, when we passed this bill for the work group to look at it, there was no money attached. And for us to actually go out and do the actuarials requires money, which is why we want to do the more formal process of a blueprint. I am very eager to see dental be a part of it. And we won't know whether we can fit in additional benefits until we see what the numbers come back. So to me, this is just the next step forward in exploring the reality of what we're conceptually would like to see, which does include dental.
I don't think the intent was to, once they submitted a blueprint, then to go ahead without regard to
exactly. No, absolutely after the blueprint, and I don't remember where the waiver fits in that process, but the idea was when we have real numbers, let's come back to the legislature and see if we want to go in this direction.
How much you want to do?
Guys, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4017 and open the public hearing on House Bill 4141. Representative Hayden, would you like to kick us off on that?
Would you like me to do it from up here? Or
you can do it wherever you want.
I'll go down there and talk to you.
More formal?
More formal.
The next panel will be everybody that signed up for the bill.
Courtney Johnston, Josh Ballack, and Cindy Becker.
And I'll ask, Representative Hayden can be as long and windy as he usually is, but I'll ask the rest of you to be pretty brief.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick and committee. My name is Cedric Hayden, State Representative for House District 7. Today, to ask for your support on behalf of Bill 4141. A little history on this. This is a very fairly simple, small bill with possible ramifications that affect our citizens that are covered through the Oregon Health Plan. This last year in 2015, the Oregon Health Authority on three different occasions changed their internal rule on how they address these areas that CCOs cover geographically. And through three of those changes throughout 2015, my concern with that is it creates an instability particularly with our CCOs, as they need to know what their contracts are and what the ability of the Oregon Health Authority is to change that contract retroactively. Because of the three changes, I went to the Legislative Council and asked for an opinion. And when they looked at this matter, they came to the conclusion that even though the Oregon Health Authority, and this is on OLIS today for you to look at, they're saying that the Oregon Health Authority has the ability to look at these CCO service areas, but when they take into account the rule changes that have been placed, they're wrapping this up saying, in other words, it appears that the rule gives the authority complete discretion to determine that a CCO would no longer serve all or portions of the service area. The concern with that is that the CCOs need stability. The patients that are covered by the CCO need to know that their doctors are still going to be there. We are not asking that the Oregon Health Authority doesn't have the ability to go in and make sure that those services are provided when there is a time that they need to do that, but that there are just some simple parameters, some sidebars on when they can and can't do that. So it is a simple request by it is supported by many of the CCOs. I won't say that it's supported by all of them. Some of them feel that the current rule they can live with, and others feel that they would like to see more stability. So I appreciate the opportunity to present this. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hayden. It's my intention, incidentally, to carry this over until Monday, where we have another contracting issue and be able to juxtapose both of them.
And I'll have the paperwork.
Thank you. Any questions, Representative Hayden? Thank you, sir. Can we have the panel, please?
Okay. For the record, Courtney Johnston here today on behalf of the Coalition for a Healthy Oregon, which represents organizations working with eight of the 16 CCOs here. I'm here today in support of House Bill 4141. I don't want to repeat anything that the good representative said. I thought he covered it pretty well. This bill is here today to help ensure that the CCOs have some stability in making long-term investments in their communities. I do want to thank the recognize that the agency and Director Saxton did put some effort into trying to fix this issue, and with this bill, the rule went through many iterations. She extended the comment period. We've got the final language on January 7th, and as he mentioned with the legislative opinion, it just didn't quite get all the way there yet. So I don't want to go into too much detail. I'm going to let these experts on the ground kind of explain what it means for them. Thank you.
Chair Greenlink, members of the committee, for the record, Josh Ballack, AllCare, Vice President of Government Relations for AllCare Health. We're a CCO located in Jackson, Josephine, Curry, and just a little bit of Douglas County. So I've been a part of this for quite some time, and this particular rule, I think the Oregon Health Authority in the final iteration was trying to get to a place. I give an awful lot of credit to Dr. Shahan and Beth Ann Darby for actually trying to really find a common ground. It just didn't quite get there. We had both this legislative opinion, but also our lawyers take a look at it, and there just wasn't the level of protection to make sure that we didn't have, you know, this opening where you could have the authority, you know, and I'm not saying that it's the authority would do it, but there is that fear that they could arbitrarily go outside of the contract and then reassign members or bring in new CCOs, and that makes it really hard to make long-term impactful investments in the community. I think one of the great things in transformation and that's going on right now is that, as Chair Greenlink has talked about, that we need to really move on to not just picking the low-hanging fruit. And what we've started to do is invest in schools and invest in housing and invest in food. And these are returns on investment which we probably won't
policy for decades, but it's the right thing to do. It's making a healthier community, and this bill will help us to be able to make sure that we can convince our members and our other stakeholders in our community that we're going to be here for a long time and be able to really really improve the health of our communities. So with that, I want to thank you, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cindy Becker, and I am the Vice President for Community and Government Relations for Family Care Health. Thank you very much, Representative Hayden, for your explanation of the bill. It was spot on, and we are 100% in support of this bill. The initial, as I said in the written testimony that I sent out to folks, the bill started out back in July, and it was to rectify an issue that had happened last year on the post with a couple of CCOs, and then the happened with the bill is the authority then added language for itself, giving itself authority to change service areas. As my colleague said, this went through several iterations, but upon reading this by several lawyers, the final bill that they came out, excuse me, the final rule that was published in January that was retroactive to December essentially still gives the agency broad authority to change a service area. And, you know, we believe that there's sufficient remedies in the contract. If a CCO is not performing, then the agency does have remedies to deal with that and also in terms of service areas. For us, for family care, it has also been a specific concern because the agency did put out a solicitation in November for other CCOs who might be interested in taking over family care's service area. Even though we have a signed contract for 2016, that solicitation is still on the books, and the agency is still continuing that. So,
I hear there were lots of offers.
Excuse me?
I hear there were lots of offers.
Thank you very much, Chair Greenlick. There were several offers, but some of them were even in-state. But anyway, we believe that this bill will clarify the language and what authority the Oregon Health Authority has to make these changes.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Is OHA going to have a comment on this bill or the one on contracting next? Is there anybody here from OHA?
They were in the back, but they might be gone.
Anyway.
There I am.
You might want to have that. I'm going to carry over. Well, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4141, announce we're carrying over a work session on 4141 until Monday. And I'm going to open public hearing on House Bill 4108. Madam Administrator.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4108 provides for licensing and regulation of anesthesiologist assistants, has an operative date of January 1, 2017, has an emergency clause effective on passage. And I believe Representative Hack is in the room, if she...
Yep.
Yes?
Please. You know the drill.
Hi, I do. Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jody Hack, and I represent House District 19, which includes South Salem, Almsville, and Turner. I'm here on behalf of House Bill 4108. The bill would provide a wonderful opportunity for credentialed healthcare professionals to start a promising new career as an anesthesiology assistant. This position requires strict clinical training standards and constant supervision from a physician. Patients can rest assured that they are receiving the highest level of care without compromising quality. Many states have already adopted this position, and skilled healthcare professionals are moving to those states for employment as AAs. House Bill 4108 would give them a reason to come home and provide their fellow Oregonians with the best healthcare possible. I'm going to bring up a Dr. Kate Ropp. She is, and she can explain the bill in detail better than I can, since that's their world and not mine. One of the things, we're going to watch a quick video if we can, but one of the things that I wanted to stress too is that my hope with this bill is that there's room for both the nursing group that does this kind of work and the anesthesiology assistant. So hopefully you're going to see that by the testimony that you're going to hear today. I believe it's a much needed position in our state, and I hope that you'll consider and take a look at it and give it a possible work session today, since I know we're up against a deadline to do that. So we're going to do the... Just a quick video, and then I'll turn it over. There's no sound.
Anesthesia CAT team model.
I did a nice job.
Extensive training in all aspects.
Where are we?
Okay.
Yeah. Sure.
Don't get used to it.
A 4-minute video.
A highly skilled health professional. Work with licensed anesthesiologists as part of an anesthesia CAT team model. Extensive training in all aspects of the delivery and maintenance of anesthesia and advanced practice monitoring techniques ensures that certified AAs implement and provide the best care for our patients.
I have worked with many certified AAs, some with years of experience, others fresh out of training. Either way, they are well prepared for all aspects of perioperative patient care. They perform preoperative patient consults, review labs, EKGs, chest x-rays, MRIs, and a myriad of other patient tests. They place intravenous catheters, intra-arterial catheters, and pain control blocks that prepare a patient for surgery. They are trained in advanced airway and life supportive techniques that save lives. I can rely on them as a part of the anesthesia care team to fully care for each and every patient.
We work together, sharing our knowledge and skills to provide both safe and excellent care for our patients.
Working with certified AAs, I can run up to 4 operating rooms at once, increasing the quality of care and providing greater access to the operating room and various patient care settings.
All AA education programs award a master's degree and are affiliated with an accredited medical school. Certified AAs work only within this model and under the medical direction of a physician anesthesiologist.
Before practicing, an AA passes a national certification exam developed in conjunction with the National Board of Medical Examiners, the same entity which develops the board exam for anesthesiologists. AAs must recertify every 6 years.
Each member of the anesthesia care team collectively conducts a patient interview prior to surgery, formulating the best anesthetic plan. The cooperative model is the future of quality health care.
Certified AAs practice in numerous surgical settings.
From preoperative clinics to ambulatory surgery centers to large hospitals, AAs provide care to patients across the spectrum of surgical specialties. We brought certified AAs into our practice a few years ago. By doing that, we were able to not only provide an increased level of patient safety, but also to increase patient access to the operating room. My facility is now able to provide more surgeries to patients sooner. The patients I see are also much more satisfied and have been taken care of quickly, safely, as well as cost-effectively.
At the American Academy of Anesthesiologist Assistants, we encourage more and more doctors to hire certified AAs. Our goal is 100% licensure across the country. AA licensure is gaining wide acceptance, and every year we see more states including AAs as physician extenders to meet growing demands for anesthesia providers. The American Academy of Anesthesiologist Assistants encourages excellence in patient care through education, advocacy, and promotion of the anesthesia care team by advancement of the AA profession. By training pre-med students as advanced anesthesia physician extenders, we eliminate pulling from already stretched critical care nursing supply.
Anesthesiologists have always been and will continue to be leaders in innovation when it comes to patient safety. Certified AAs are proud to be part of the solution.
Certified Anesthesiologist Assistants, we love our job, and we highly value our role and responsibility in being able to take care of patients. They deserve the very best. The American Academy of Anesthesiologist Assistants. Effective, expert, team, care.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and members of the House Health Care Committee, my name is Kate Ropp. I'm a pediatric anesthesiologist at Legacy Emanuel Hospital in Portland, and I am president-elect of the Oregon Society of Anesthesiologists. I'm here today to ask you to support House Bill 4108. This bill is also supported by the American Society of Anesthesiologists, the Oregon Society of Anesthesiologists, and the Oregon Medical Association. I completed my anesthesiology residency and pediatric anesthesiology fellowship at Oregon Health and Science University. The reason we're here today asking for support of this bill is because demand for surgical services is rising due to our aging population and expansion of health care insurance via the Affordable Care Act. Anesthesiologists are trying to figure out how to continue to provide high-quality care to the expanding population, and we want to be able to hire from the broadest pool of qualified applicants as physician extender positions. My surgical colleagues are able to hire both nurse practitioners and physician assistants to help them in achieving their goals. Oregon anesthesiologists would like the similar option of hiring both nurse anesthetists and anesthesiologist assistants to meet their needs. You have heard reference to the anesthesia care team model. I'd like to explain that for those of you who aren't familiar with this. In this model, there is an anesthesia provider in constant contact with the patient. That's an anesthesiology resident, fellow, nurse anesthetist, or anesthesiologist assistant. Then there's a physician anesthesiologist who supervises 2 to 4 rooms, formulating the anesthesia plan in and out of the room, there for putting the patient to sleep, waking them up, and at all critical intervals. This anesthesia care team model is already being practiced at Oregon Health Sciences University, the VA Hospital, Kaiser Hospitals, and Legacy Good Samaritan Hospital, just to name a few. Within the anesthesia care team model, anesthesiologist assistants function identically to nurse anesthetists. Because nurse anesthetists are already practicing in Oregon and most of us are familiar with their role, I will draw parallels throughout my testimony between the two professions. My written testimony has detailed information about the training of anesthesiologist assistants. I won't bore you with the numbers, but suffice it to say they have extensive didactic and clinical training in the administration of anesthesia. They are recognized by the government in that Medicare, Medicaid, and TRICARE pay for their services as a recognized anesthesia provider. Anesthesiologist assistants may practice within the VA health system and within 17 jurisdictions in the United States so far. In practice, the primary difference between anesthesiologist assistants and nurse anesthetists is that anesthesiologist assistants only practice within the care team model. Nurse anesthetists often practice within the care team model as well, but in a handful of states, including Oregon, they also have the ability to practice independently. Anesthesiology is extremely safe these days, thanks to the research and development made by physician anesthesiologists over the years. However, I work in the operating room on a daily basis, and I can tell you things change very quickly. And I firmly believe that an anesthesiologist should always be involved in the anesthetic care of a patient. Patients agree. The American Medical Association conducted a survey, and 70% of patients believe that a doctor should be involved in their administration and monitoring of anesthesia levels. House Bill 4108 would grant anesthesiologist assistants the opportunity to practice within their scope and training in the state of Oregon. It does not mandate that anybody hire them. It just allows them to apply for a job. It would broaden the pool of qualified applicants so that physicians can hire from a broad pool of highly qualified individuals so that the best and brightest can help us provide care for Oregonians. The licensure process is already in place. The Oregon Medical Board is already responsible for licensing physicians, physician assistants, podiatrists, and massage therapies. I would like to counter some of the arguments that have been made in the past against bills such as this. People have claimed that anesthesiologist assistants would drive up the cost of anesthesia, that they would threaten jobs of other anesthesia providers in the state, and that anesthesiologists would provide less safe anesthesia. As far as the cost goes, Medicare, Medicaid, and other insurers reimburse anesthesia services the same no matter who delivers it. A $100 bill is paid out no matter who did the anesthetic. If I provided the anesthesia myself, I keep the $100. If a nurse anesthetist was practicing independently, they keep the $100. If I were supervising a nurse anesthetist, we would split it 50-50.
This bill would not...
Any $100 bills in anesthesia.
Maybe immediately came out.
Which hospitals is that?
But this bill would not increase costs to patients. The difference in income between physicians and nurse anesthetists is based on their employment and salary structure, not on billing. The threat to existing jobs, anesthesiologist assistants have been around for almost 50 years. They've been practicing together in states such as Georgia for that long. And nurse anesthetists and anesthesiologists often work in the same building, in the same department, side by side. And neither specialty has been pushed out by the other in that amount of time. Finally, safety. The states such as Ohio and Kentucky have studied the anesthetics that involve nurse anesthetists and anesthesiologist assistants and have concluded that there's no difference in safety or outcomes. Malpractice insurers are really good at assessing risk, and they insure both of those specialties at the same rate. The anesthesia care team model, in conclusion, is already functioning safely and efficiently throughout Oregon and the United States, with guaranteed physician involvement in the anesthesia care from start to finish. We would like the opportunity to hire from a broad pool of physician extenders, and I would ask that the committee please bring this bill to a vote. Thank you.
Any questions?
Two other people.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question about workforce needs.
Mm-hmm.
I think I've been pretty clear with speaking with a number of you that my concern is we have a school that's producing nurse anesthetists, and I'm not sure if I'm saying CRNAs, and we don't have a school producing AAs.
Mm-hmm.
And we should be making sure that we, if we have a school, that we're fully employing the ones who are graduating from our own school before bringing in people. And so I wonder if you can address at all the workforce need, because I haven't yet seen evidence that there's that we have not been able to meet the need for those slots.
Mm-hmm.
I know there's sometimes a preference between whether you do an AA or a CRNA, but I'm not seeing a big workforce need.
Mark Dorling is here and is going to be testifying. He's the president of Oregon Anesthesiology Group, the largest private practice group in the state of Oregon, and he is prepared to talk about workforce needs. I'm more of a worker bee.
The one point I would make to that is the school that you reference actually has talked about offering the courses to be an AA. However, they aren't going to look too closely at that until they can actually practice in the state. So I think it's important to take into consideration that there's a possibility that that could be a new career coursework at one of our schools in our state that could not only bring people to our state, but also keep those that want to be here in Oregon attending a school like that and being employed. So you'll hear more on the other end. One thing I did want to bring up that was brought to my attention just briefly recently before I, not long before I walked in, was that AAs aren't required to have a special degree before they enter into their program. So I did a little poking around with that, and it's the same identical if you were to enter the medical profession to get a medical degree. So I did want to clarify that because I know there's been some angst over the fact that that's not the case with the CNC.
I understand.
So you can have, let's say you can have a bachelor's degree in business.
Yeah.
Then you can go on and get your master's. So it's no different. If you wanted to apply to medical school, you could have a bachelor's if you wanted to, and if you got in, you could go to medical school. So this is no different than that.
Anesthesiologists basically satisfy all the pre-med requirements that an individual who was going to medical school would do in their undergraduate degree. They have a bachelor's degree, and they've satisfied all the pre-medical requirements before they
get a master's degree as a part of their training.
They get a four-year bachelor's degree with pre-med emphasis, and then they go on to a two-year master's program. And that all that's available in the written testimony.
Yeah. All right. Let's call the next panel. You're welcome to stay or not.
Thank you. I'll hang out for a little bit.
Sure.
Thank you so much.
Mark Norling, Peggy Allen, and Dr. Jenny.
With one more.
Awesome. Chair Greenlick and the
members of the Health Committee and House Committee on Healthcare, thanks for having us here to talk about AAs today, certified AAs. I'm Mark Norling. I'm a physician anesthesiologist with Oregon Anesthesiology Group. We are the largest independent anesthesiology group in the state. We cover hospitals from Springfield to Corvallis to Salem and Portland metro area. And we've been in the communities for over 30 years. We have over 250 anesthesiologists. I'd really like to ask your support for this bill, number 4108. You've heard all about the training and what CAAs are all about. And so I'm not going to go over that again because you have that. What I want to do is look at this from a business perspective. So in terms of workforce particularly, you brought that up. Our group is undergoing a bit of a change. We've been physician only for the duration. We have just recently secured a contract to staff obstetric anesthesia at some sites that we currently just staff the operating room. The thing about this contract is our client has currently a care team model with CRNAs and would like us to continue. And we said yes, we would like to do that. We've been talking about this for years in terms of trying to get into this particular mode of anesthesia. The care team is the most common mode of anesthesia throughout the nation. The West Coast is a little slow sometimes in terms of getting these this way. So anyway, in terms of getting having CRNAs in the care team to work with us for this new service that we're going to provide, we have to hire CRNAs. Ideally, it'd be nice to be able to hire the ones that are currently on the service. Unfortunately, this goes into some workforce issues that we had, which is even though there's a lot of CRNAs in the state, there's a school in the state, not all of them are actually available for us. For example, there are at least two large CRNA groups in the state that have very strict, significant non-competes in their contract, which have prohibited us from even talking to them about continuing to serve the place that they've been serving for years. We're working around that. It's a business issue, without question. We're working around it, but it's a big delay in making it difficult. These strict non-competes create a workforce issue when maybe there shouldn't be one. The other thing to think about workforce-wise is the fact that there are different subspecialties of anesthesia. Obstetric is one of them. Especially when you're managing high-risk obstetric care, you really need people who have a lot of experience or highly trained for the CRNAs. And so if that is a smaller niche, which makes a smaller workforce for us to be able to go after. So we have to extend out more nationally, like we do for a lot of our spots anyway. But just the fact that there are enough CRNAs in the state to cover what seems to be right is not necessarily true in all circumstances. So from my standpoint, certified anesthesiologist assistants are trained at least as well as CRNAs. I think it's pretty clear. They work in a lot of different places and do very well. They work in a care team exactly, like Dr. Robb said, exactly as a CRNA. For me, employing CRNAs, we're happy to do it. We're excited. We want to do it. We have a definite need. It's difficult to fill them all out. We'll get there. I have no question about it. I'm not saying we're not going to get it if we don't have CAAs. That's not true. We're going to have this service staffed. We may have to staff this service with more physicians than we currently thought would work. We'll eventually get there. No question about it, CAAs or not. I'm looking at the future and the fact that this is only a start for our group into having physician extenders like CRNAs in the care team model the way we use them. It'd be great to have a wider pool of applicants for these positions that are going to be important. We're growing, the state's growing, ACA has made healthcare grow even further, and we're going to need these providers in the future. And I also, I've talked to multiple people who work with both CAAs and CRNAs in other states together, and they collaborate together. They work in the same department together. It's not one or the other. You can't, if you go down the road of AAs, doesn't mean you don't hire CRNAs. That's not the way it's going to go. In our group, I can tell you the vast majority of our non-physician anesthesia providers are going to be CRNAs. It's a numbers game. There's 39,000 CRNAs in the states versus 1,500 or so AAs. We're not talking about doing anything against the CRNAs. They provide very good care. They're a very important part of the care team. This is just about having people who are actually trained to do the job and being able to do the job in their state, in their home state, if possible.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chairman Greenlick and committee members. Thank you for hearing this, holding this hearing about this very important bill. My name is Dr. Peggy Allen. I live in North Portland. I practice at Legacy Emanuel and Randall Children's Hospital as an anesthesiologist with a board certification subspecialty of pediatric anesthesia. I also serve as a treasurer for the Oregon Society of Anesthesiologists and as a member of the House of Delegates for the American Society of Anesthesiologists. I've been in practice for 10 years. The first 7 years after finishing my training at the Mayo Clinic, I worked in a care team model. So I have a lot of experience working with nurse anesthetists, student nurse anesthetists in the care team model as well. I come to you today as a representative of the Oregon Society of Anesthesiologists to strongly encourage your support for House Bill 4108, which provides for the licensure and regulation of anesthesiologist assistants. This bill is necessary simply to allow these medical professionals the opportunity to work in Oregon alongside physician anesthesiologists providing excellent care for our families, friends, and fellow Oregonians. So anesthesia is a little bit confusing. Who's doing the anesthesia? So just to clarify it, anesthesia is provided by a trained medical professional no matter where you are. In Oregon, who that medical professional is varies depending on the site where you're having your surgery or your procedure done. In many hospitals and surgery centers, anesthesia is delivered directly by a physician anesthesiologist such as myself. That's what I do every day. I'm one-on-one with every single one of my patients. As in the past, I've been on the care team model, but currently I'm one-on-one with all my patients. I'm with my patient from the pre-op area into the operating room for every second of the surgery, and then into the recovery room after surgery, making sure that they are safe and comfortable throughout their experience. I take care of very sick newborns, burn victims, trauma patients, and on occasion, healthy patients. At other hospitals and surgery centers, you may be cared for by an anesthesia care team, as has been discussed. And this is where the physician anesthesiologist works with either a resident physician, for example, at the university, or a nurse anesthetist to develop and implement a plan for each patient's anesthetic care. This physician may supervise multiple anesthesia providers, generally up to four different providers. Oregon is nearly unique in that we do allow nurse anesthetists to practice completely independently. There are some locations in this state, primarily in rural areas, where the nurse anesthetist is not directly supervised by a physician anesthesiologist, but rather perhaps supervised by the surgeon or perhaps supervised by no physician at all. What House Bill 4108 does is simply to allow the licensure of anesthesiologist assistants, an option that is available in 17 other jurisdictions, as well as Guam and in the VA. So our state's population is clearly growing. We're the number one destination to come to, according to all the moving companies. And we're growing and aging. Meanwhile, with that successful rollout of the American Health Care Act, more people than ever have insurance, have coverage, and have medical needs that are finally being addressed. So our surgical volume is increasing, so we have increasing operative cases to do. To meet those needs for our patients in a timely fashion, we need to expand the number of anesthesia professionals in Oregon. By allowing the licensure of AAs, Oregon will promote improved access for surgical services, support physician-led, team-based anesthesia care, and create new jobs. I attend the American Society of Anesthesiologists meeting every year representing the Oregon anesthesiologists. When I'm there, I meet AAs. They're smart, they're well-educated, they're very highly trained. They are ready to provide the medical services that patients need. And like in any other profession, there are AAs who go out of state for training, as there are only 10 training areas in the country. In fact, if any Oregonian at this time wants to become an AA, they have to leave the state of Oregon to get trained. because there is no school currently that offers AA training within the state.
Can I ask you to wrap up, please?
Yes, sir. So many of these trainees do
want... Two more witnesses, and we need to be done at 2:45.
Yes, sir. Three more sentences. Many of these trainees do want to return to their home state after their training is completed. And HB 4108 simply allows them the opportunity to come back. So I'm asking you to move this bill to a vote and vote in favor of having a working session on this vote. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I'll be very brief. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on behalf of House Bill 4108. My name is Joanne Jenny. I'm a retired anesthesiologist, spent 4 decades practicing anesthesia in Portland. I've seen it all. I've also seen this committee several times, and I am happy to say that I think it's time for this committee to take the time to support a vote for a work session. I'm talking to you about the fact that I'm thinking of the future. Physicians are retiring earlier because the workload and the hours and all the things that are happening, namely medical records and all the things that are happening, are taking a toll on patient care in the sense that physicians want to take care of patients and not dictate and look at medical records. So having an anesthesiology assistant would be very beneficial. It's time to start the clock moving forward. It takes time for the Oregon Medical Board to get this process in place, even though it's in place with PAs, as they do have now. It's not going to cost any more, as you've heard. It's also going to meet the triple aim. We're going to have accountability, we're going to have access, we're going to have satisfaction, and we're going to have patient care, the best patient care team can provide for Oregonians. Manpower, yes. People are retiring. We need to have an opportunity to let Oregonians come back and work in Oregon. The last testimony we had last year at the bill session, a young man came to talk to us and wanted to come back to Oregon, but couldn't because he couldn't get a license in Oregon to work as an AA. We've got to stop this and allow the door to be open so we have an equal playing field and so that people can have the best care possible. Final example, the anesthesia nurses don't have the same number of training cases that the AAs and anesthesiologists have. If you happen to have a disaster pending in a small hospital, some of these providers who are there independently don't have the training, don't have the access, and they need help. We can provide help by having the institutions along the current I-5 beltway, namely all the way from Portland to Medford, have anesthesia assistants helping so that there can be an expansion of quality care team in this state. So finally, I'm just saying, would this committee please have an opportunity to have a work session, and would you support it at this time? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Please call the next panel.
Fawn Berry and Michael Ray.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, Fawn Berry, representing the Oregon Association of Nurse Anesthetists. I'm going to be very brief. I just wanted to cover a couple of things that I heard in the testimony earlier. First, I did want to call your attention to Section 3 of the bill. It does say that it's under the supervision of an anesthesiologist or anesthesiologist organization. The bill does not speak to the direct supervision by an anesthesiologist. And the video that we saw highlighted that they typically are 2 to 4 AAs being overseen by an anesthesiologist, but the bill doesn't reference any kind of a ratio. So I did want to make sure that you knew that. And then also in reference to the contract issue that they discussed, there are 35 CRNAs who are going to be out of work soon because of this contract change that's happened in Portland. And I did want to let you know that they have been released from their non-compete contract, so they are available to start working in another area. Just wanted to clarify that. And I will introduce to you Michael Ray, who is the chair of our Government Affairs Committee.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick and members of the Health Committee. As I said, my name is Michael Ray. I'm a certified registered nurse anesthetist and a small business owner with a company called Prestantia Associates. And I hire both physician anesthesiologists and CRNAs to work in hospitals, ambulatory surgery centers, and physician offices. I'm also, as Juan says, the director on the Oregon Association of Nurse Anesthetists. I've been a practicing CRNA for over 16 years. I've worked in every setting from the anesthesia care team all that's been discussed to an independent practice of CRNAs to a business owner right now that I'm currently doing. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity before this committee, and I would like to have you oppose this bill, HB 4108. This bill recognizes a new type of provider called the anesthesiologist assistants, and for over 100 years, we have seen safe anesthesia care in Oregon delivered by CRNAs and physician anesthesiologists. Currently, there is no workforce issues requiring AAs to come into Oregon that we should see. CRNAs are far better qualified providers to provide anesthesia, and they have a proven history with that. Just by the way of background, of becoming a CRNA, you're required to be a registered nurse before entering CRNA school and have at least 1 year of acute care experience, which is typically in a critical care setting, followed by the completion of an accredited master's level degree program, and many students are graduating from doctoral prepared, you know, degree programs as well. We then successfully pass a national certification examination, and you're able to work in whichever practice setting you like after that, including autonomous practice as an independent CRNA as required. As indicated, there really is no workforce issue for practitioners in the state. The only workforce issue may be, there's an overabundance of providers that we have. There's over 650 licensed CRNAs in the state, 350 of which are primarily practicing in Oregon currently right now. We have a school of nurse anesthesia up at OHSU, and over 40% of those graduates over the past 3 years have actually had to leave the state due to no employment within Oregon that we've seen here. As a business owner, I can tell you specifically, for every position I have posted, I get over 10 to 20 applicants that are coming in that are well qualified. So I already have a very large pool of applicants highly qualified to fill any positions that we have. So I can tell you from my personal experience, there really is no shortage of providers that we see. This previous legislature, we have seen, you know, the committee seen two similar AA bills. HB 2295 was in 2015, and SB 650 was seen in 2013. I've taken the opportunity and I've compiled a number of the letters from following constituents who have reviewed these. Mary Carlett, Program Director for OHSU Nurse Anesthesia Program. We've had several physician anesthesiologists, gastroenterologists, the Oregon Board of Nursing, Oregon Nurses Association, ARANA, and several individual CRNAs have all opposed this. Because this current bill 4108 is similar to the previous bills that we see, some reasons to oppose this are very similar because they're virtually unchanged. There's basically three reasons we sort of look at to that ARANA would want to oppose this bill. One, AAs really do not increase access to care to Oregonians. Two, maybe that negative economic impact, which we won't get into, we've heard some testimony on that. And three, there really is a difference between the education scope of practice that's here in Maine. When we look at the access of care to Oregon, CRNAs can provide care in virtually any setting that we see. CRNAs can practice in any setting, including hospitals, ASCs, physician offices, and our VA systems. CRNAs are the only anesthesia provider in many rural and underserved communities that we have. Because AAs have to work under the anesthesia care team model in a supervised practice, they cannot work in many of these rural or underserved settings that we currently have. And so that limits their ability and their utilization that we see within the state. The failure to meet demands, if for any reason the AAs, supervising anesthesiologist, is unavailable, they cannot deliver the care, you know, that they see. They are not trained to have an autonomous practice, as CRNAs are, so there can often be delays in care in terms of what we see. Finally, there are no proven outcome studies, you know, discussed within peer-reviewed journals that we see that analyze the quality of anesthesia care that is delivered by the AA team that we see. Louisiana has actually passed legislation, you know, effectively prohibiting AA practice, declaring that CRNAs receive a higher level of education and training than do AAs. The education and scope of practice...
Can I ask you to wrap up, please?
2 minutes or less.
All right.
The CRNAs are trained to basically have practice before they ever enter an anesthesia program that they have. They're RNs, they have hands-on experience for what we see. The AA is limited scope is that they do not have any clinical experience with a patient or hands-on patient care before they enter this anesthesia program. They're not full-service providers. you know, often they are treated, trained as technicians, and if we look at one of the largest programs at Emory University, they do not even teach regional anesthesia at all for their AAs that they have. So they do not do nerve blocks or other, you know, blocks to work in obstetrical area. So the healthcare landscape in the United States we see is changing, and CRNAs play a critical role in delivering this care. We are high-quality providers, we have a proven track record, and I urge you to oppose HB 4108, as will have a negative impact on Oregonians' health.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Thank you, guys. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4108. I'm going to review the bills I think we're carrying over till Monday. We're carrying over House Bill 4062 for a work session, 4105 for a work session, 4017 for a work session, and 4141. We also have a couple other ones scheduled already.
Yes.
I'm going to ask you to take a look at the amendments on all this that we're looking at. I'll ask Sandy to send out, I've asked her to send out an email just to review what amendments we're looking at. We should be moving pretty quickly, although we don't have to finish everything on Monday. We have Wednesday as well. So, are there any questions?
Not yet.
We're adjourned.